You're tuned in to another episode of Recruitment Entrepreneurs by Recruit CRM. Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Recruitment Entrepreneurs by Recruit CRM. And today I have the privilege of hosting the awesome Greg Savage. And Greg, thanks for taking the time to do this. I'm sure the audience is going to enjoy this episode.
No, thanks for having me on your podcast, Sean. I'm looking forward to it.
Brilliant. And so, Greg, for those that don't know you, like, how would you introduce yourself?
Well, I'd be shocked that there are any recruiters who don't know me, Sean. I'm kidding, of course. I've been a recruiter and in the recruitment field for 40 years, Sean. I guess the important, obviously, we don't want to go through that entire CV right now, but mostly it's been owning and running recruitment companies. Recruitment Solutions, I started when I was about 27 with two other guys, and we built it up to a point where it was listed on the Australian Stock Exchange via an IPO. So that was very exciting. That was 10 years. And then I ran the international business of Acrint, which is a US staffing firm. And that was another 10-year stint where I was opening offices around the world, including India, Europe, right away, 35 offices in 17 countries, I like to say, in the end. There's lots of stories there which we can delve into, including what happened when there was a big downturn. Other things as well, but mostly in the last 7 years since I sold my last business, I've been an advisor to recruitment companies. And right now I'm on the board of 14 recruitment companies. I invested in some of them. Wow. And so I talk to owners of recruitment companies every day. So that's my life.
And Greg, for guys watching this and being like, okay, this guy's a badass. He's like killed it in the recruitment industry. Did you always start off that way? Like growing up, and I think you grew up in Sydney, or if I'm not wrong.
No, actually, I grew up in South Africa. So, cool. I was born in Cape Town. My dad was an Englishman, come back from the war, Second World War. He was in a Japanese prison of war camp for 3 years. Crazy. And not many people survived that, actually. And he came back to the UK, he's English, and decided, you know, England after the war was not a very appealing place, and he settled in South Africa. So I was brought up in a very middle class. My dad was a shoe salesman. He did well. He built his own business. South Africa was an interesting place at the time. It still is. It was under the apartheid rule, which is, people divided by race. Yeah. So that was fascinating. And for many reasons, mostly engineered by my father, I came to Australia when I was 20. He didn't want his sons to grow up in South Africa and end up going to the army to protect a sort of regime we didn't believe in. Yeah. So I came to Australia when I was 20. And I started as a recruiter when I was 21.
And Greg, to cut in that, did you know you were going to be a recruiter growing up? What was dream job growing up, as a kid?
Well, you've got to understand, first of all, I was very young. Secondly, I was 1 year into this new country, Australia. But thirdly, the recruitment industry was not even known, really. Yeah. We're talking 40 years. I believe quite a while before you were born, Sean. It did exist, the industry. It was mostly executive search, or what we used to call secretarial recruitment, which is office support administration. I'd never heard of the industry. I had a degree in psychology, and I was looking for a job, my first job out of university. I'd worked in bars and things prior to that. And I was, in those days, we talked about personnel management. The phrase human resources was not being coined yet. And I didn't even know recruitment agencies. And I was applying for personnel management jobs and even social work jobs with my psychology degree. My sister had a friend whose dad ran an executive search firm. She lined up a meeting for me, and he, a very nice gentleman called Jim Raggett, he saw me, I think, just out of it because his son had asked. And I'll never forget what he said, Sean.
What did he
say? We had a good chat. He took the interview seriously. I was 21. And he said, Greg, you don't have any skills or experience that our clients would hire, but you seem like a likely lad. How would you like to work as an executive search consultant?
Wow.
And 28th of January, 1980, which you'll find in my book, Sean, which I'm sure you've read. And if you haven't, I'll send it to you. I started as a recruiter. I was 21 and the next youngest recruiter was 45 because they were all ex-commercial guys and they were all men. And it was executive search, selling retainers. And that's how I started in recruitment. So I was incredibly lucky to fall into a job that perfectly suited my personality and my ethos. And I've thrived at it. Not always been successful, but it's suited me.
And Greg, to go back to that, right? Because this is fascinating, right? So in 1980, and we're sharing the same drink, which is good. And in 1980, when you started as a recruiter as a 21-year-old, what were the economics like, right? Like, was there a salary? Was it commission only? How did this world work back then?
Well, I can tell you exactly. My salary was $10,000 a year, and there was no problem with that. It was, that was probably quite good. But I'll explain this to you, which will be fascinating. You've got to remember the $10,000 was my annual salary, and there were bonuses, but they weren't commissions. It's like on the company result. We sold retainers, right? I was doing senior accounting roles, engineering roles. We didn't specialize. It was just senior. So one-third of the fee was often $2,000 or $3,000. Yeah. When you went and saw a client, you sold us an assignment. You sold a retainer. You'd invoice the client for $3,000. But we also sold what we called client-paid advertising. Remember pre-internet, right?
Yeah.
The jobs were advertised in the press. And a display ad might cost $2,000. So by the time I'd left that client meeting, I'd sold him $5,000 worth of service, and my salary was $10,000
a year.
So it was big money, right? So you had to, and I was 21 years old. I'd only been shaving for a couple of years. So you had to learn credibility and to set. And I must admit, it's held me in really good stead because. Yes, of course, I've got into contingent recruitment over the years and all the rest of it, but I always believed in my value and the value of what we do and never discounted when I didn't need to push back.
And Greg, if I may cut into that, right? How did your boss let a 21-year-old go out and do business development? Like, were you actually supposed to do business development your first 3 months or were you like a resourcer?
No. I was doing full-on assignments from the beginning. I got some training. I hardly remember the training. I was paired with a 60-year-old man called Harold, who was very generous with his time, and he trained. And I remember a couple of stories. One is I remember I was interviewing a senior engineering guy, and in the middle of the interview, he just, this is embarrassing, right? He put his 40 years ago. He put his hands on the table and said, "I'm not being interviewed by a whippersnapper," right? So I went and got Harold, and Harold calmed him down. And Harold said to me, "Greg, it's fine. You're young." He said, "Every day you'll get better, and one day people will be coming to you for advice." And it made me feel better. It turned out to be true, and that's what I do every day. So yeah, I made some blunders, and I had to learn. And I learned the value of open-ended questioning. And you asked about business development. We used to turn up at clients, and I distinctly remember, Adelaide's a very flat. Laid out city in squares. Yes. And I distinctly remember I was working in Adelaide and in South Australia, driving up to a client's building and sitting outside, holding onto the steering wheel, plucking up courage to go in because I was going to go and see a CEO or a CFO, probably a 40-year-old man, but to me, a god. I'm 21. My last job was serving beers in the bar. I was 3 years out of boarding school in Africa. Right? Yeah. And here I was selling executive. But, it taught me courage. It taught me the gift of the gab and how to position myself. And every day I was learning. Within a year, I was still young, but I was on my game, and I think I was getting better.
And in that first year, Greg, I know this is a long time ago, so I'm not sure if you remember, but do you remember how much you sold in your first year? Like how much revenue you generated for your firm?
I don't remember. I honestly don't remember. And I wasn't rewarded, I don't think, on distinct commission per billing. And also, for at least the first 6 months, I was paired with a more senior consultant. I was eased into it. I wasn't thrown in. They weren't stupid. I was eased into it. But I did okay. So they're very sick. And I remember them sending me up to Darwin to do assignments. I was still 21, flying up to Darwin and in meetings, I was the youngest guy in the room, and I was the consultant.
it's crazy.
Interesting now.
Yeah. It's crazy to think about, right? And how did those CEOs treat you, right? You talked about an interview. But have you had instances where clients couldn't take you seriously and they were more like, what the hell? Like, why? No.
I mean, look, that's a long time ago, but pretty soon, you know, you got to remember this. And I say this to junior recruiters now. After 6 months, or certainly 12 months, I had more recruitment experience than they had in their entire lives.
Yeah, because that's what you were doing all the time,
20%. That's what I'm doing. I was interviewing more people than them. And that's how I think about everything. And I never feel, well, now it's, you know, but I never feel out of my depth as long as we're talking about recruitment or rugby.
Of course.
So I never feel out of my depth in that sense. And so, therefore, I don't allow myself to be intimidated. And certainly, I don't need to be now. But even as I was younger, and I coach people on this, you think you've only got 6 months experience? You've interviewed 150 people. You know the market. You know the salaries. You know what's driving candidates.
Totally.
That's valuable. Bring your value.
And Greg, what were the fees like back then? Were they the same 25, 30% in executive searches, or were they different?
Yeah, 25%, as I recall. Australian fees have dropped now. I mean, in search, they're probably the same. Australian fees are more like 18. You know, it's interesting across the world. The US is obviously higher. Japan's the highest.
Yep,
it's
crazy.
30-35%. It's great.
And Greg, now, like, you know, you got into this new job, you loved it, fit your personality. How long were you there in that first job? Do you, like?
3 years. I was three years and I loved it. But then I was about 24, 25 and I wanted to travel overseas. And I went to Europe and I traveled in the back of a camper van. Well, not in the back, in the front of a camper van with my mate. We traveled, you know, for 6 to 8 months and had a wild old time. And then I ended up back in London and I had a British passport because my dad was British. And I looked for a recruiter job and I applied for a job with a company. It's quite interesting, actually, with a company called Accountancy Personnel. Now, one of the things about that company that marks it out is I was there for two, almost 3 years in London, ended up running a branch and what have you. But that was the company that was bought by Hays when Hays got into recruitment.
Yeah.
Hays, which is the 10th biggest recruitment company in the world, were a logistics company. They bought this company for £40 million in
back then.
Yeah, that's a long time ago. And I was no longer in London. I was in London for a couple of years. I can tell you a lot of stories about what recruitment was. This was the very opposite of search. This was fast, highly paced, placing accountants in jobs. We'd make three or four permanent placements a week in that job.
Per consultant?
With a company. Sorry?
You would make three or four placements per consultant every week or like as a firm?
Not per consultant.
That's
ludicrous. And we would interview at our desk and we'd all interview in the same room. And it was pre-mobile phones, right? So if I interviewed you and I thought you were good, if you left that office and I had a great job come in, I had no way of contacting you. So the skill of getting that person to phone in from one of those London boxes four times a day. And we would make interviews for candidates without even telling the candidate. It was like a broken environment. I don't recommend it, but remember that company was sold for £40 million, right? So it was fast. It was furious. There was no reception. The phone rang. You grabbed the phone because it could be a client. If a client gave you a job, you'd take it on the phone right there and then. We were told no client visits, waste of time. Take the phone, take the job on the phone. Then you'd put your candidates sell them to the client there and then. A line up interviews because you'd found out from the candidate what time she could go on. You'd know the tube map of London in your head because you'd send someone from Barking to Hounslow. And you'd have to be thinking, payroll clock, shit, can she get to Hounslow? It's only an hour. Bang her in. And then contact her at night because she's
working.
Landline, no mobile. No email.
Yeah.
Get her to go to the interview the next morning at 8 o'clock. Do it all day. And it taught speed and urgency and memory and commercial negotiation.
And that sounds like so much more stressful than recruitment is today, right? In that it.
Well, the thing is, recruitment has its own stresses today. But in that situation, you are at the cutting edge. And remember this. Like, I'll tell you two stories. The day I started at my executive search firm, in 1980 in Adelaide, when I walked in, there was a picture of Don Bradman on the wall going out to bat at the Adelaide Oval. That made me feel good because I love sport. And that's where Don Bradman played for South Australia, some of his life. And then on the desk was three things. A Yellow Pages. Do you even know what that is? Sean?
Yeah. The Yellow Pages book. That was your marketing. Yeah.
And then there was a telephone. Of course, it was hardwired landline. And the third thing was an ashtray, because in those days, everybody smoked. Everybody. Not me.
Yeah.
Guys in Canada smoked at the desk. In London, it was, you had to understand that there was no computers, right? Yeah. Only a telephone. So if you weren't interviewing a candidate and you weren't on the phone, what were you doing?
Yeah.
There was nothing to do. So it was constantly influencing, negotiating, creating outcomes. Yeah.
And Greg, why did you and obviously now you're like this recruitment management or recruitment business guru in a sense. So how did you go from being a successful recruiter/consultant to becoming a business owner? Like, how did that transition happen and why did you do it?
Yeah, it's actually a linear story. I became I'll tell you the story quickly. In that office in Oxford Circus, London, there were eight of us around the table. Yeah. There was no interview rooms. We interviewed just there in the open. When the director came in, if he wanted to talk to you about something serious, he'd walk around the block. So he came in and he called the manager. His name was Don. And he said, "Don, come with me, walk." And they walked. And Don got fired outside the Boots chemist. And he never came. I'd never seen that guy. I've never seen him since, 40 years. We connected on LinkedIn to this day. Never saw him. Then he said, "Savage, you walk with me." I thought, I'm going to get fired. I got promoted to the management job outside the Wimpy Bar. We walked back in. He told everyone, "Greg's the boss." Anyway, it just shows you what the world was like, right? So I was managing these people. But after three English winters, I wanted to come back to Australia. And I came back with that company to their Australian office. And I became a director of that company. And managing three or four offices. And then Hayes bought the business, as I explained.
Yep. Yep.
The three of us, I was the least of the three senior people, but the three of us said to Hayes, "Look, we're running the company. It's making $2 million a year. This is in the late 80s. We would like equity in the business." They said, they were nice people, but they said, no, they're a public company. They didn't want us. So that prompted us to go and start our own business. And we did. I was 27 or 8, and we started our own business with 9 people on day one. And I was back on the desk and managing, because, you know, when you start a business, you just do whatever you've got to do.
And
that was a big success.
And Greg, do you remember the difference between the amount of money you made in your last year as a 100% professional employee versus the first year as a business owner?
A lot less as a business. Oh, much less. Because I was the director of this company and doing really well. I won't bother quoting the numbers, although I do know what they are. They won't mean anything today, but I do remember we were encouraged to stay in Hayes.
Yeah.
I was offered 4 times my salary to stay.
Wow.
I was inclined to stay, and my wife said, "But hey, why are you leaving? Why did you say you wanted to leave?" And I was like, "Well, I want to run my own business." She said, "Well, the money doesn't make any difference." So we went off and we started. Our salaries were reduced because we're funding ourselves, right? Yeah. And we hired 9 people. So most of the consultants were earning more than me for the first year. Second year, I can't remember. But in the end, you know, we listed the company on the stock exchange for a value of $60 million. Yes. So I'm not really worried about it.
You did well, right? And that's obviously recorded, and anyone can Google that.
you can look it up, and it's all in the book. My book, it's public knowledge. It was a listed company.
Yeah.
I mean, $60 million, I was only one of 3 shareholders, and it sold down. I mean, it's not about
life-changing.
What I'm saying is, the end was, worth any sacrifices financially in the beginning.
And Greg, this is an important question, right? So now you've sold your company and you've made enough money to probably last your entire life unless you go crazy, right? Is that sort of correct?
Yeah, I suppose so.
Probably. So why are you back in the grinds, mentoring people and running these academies? What's the motivation there?
Well, I mean, you're right. It's not financial, although I'd charge a fortune.
Yeah.
but that was years ago. That was 1998. And I stayed on the board of that company when it was listed for several years. And then I did 10 years with Aquint. And the motivation for that was, I've got 3 kids and I was still quite young. I was under 40. And it wasn't like, you know, you mustn't think of, even though I quoted that big number, remember that's what that was its valuation on the stock market. You know, there were many, many other shareholders. I didn't get an Amazon type thing or anything like that, right?
Of course.
It was successful, but did you make
more than like $5 million at that point from that?
Probably about that.
Something like that. And 98, right? Like you're sort of done in the sense that yes, like you can't buy a plane with that money, but you're not really working for money anymore.
But when we started that company, we didn't start it to make money. And even when we listed it, we wanted to realize some asset, but really we listed it because we wanted to take it to the next level through acquisition, which, to be perfectly honest with you, we didn't do a great job of. The company grew, everyone made money, the shareholders did fine, but we didn't really take it. You know, to be listed on the stock exchange of a value of $60 million, you are a very, very small company.
Yeah, a small cap.
And people want to see you go to $1 billion, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, then Aquent was fascinating because that American company based out of Boston, I took a couple of years off between leaving the one and the other, another child, and I went, did all some exciting things. And some recruiter phoned me up and said, you know, would you want to be the CEO of this company? And I was like, oh, no, I've never heard of them, which is pretty arrogant and stupid because when she explained it all to me, it was quite exciting. And what was exciting for me about that, it was all my experience of being in Australia, and this was to run a company that had offices in Japan and Singapore and New Zealand.
Yeah.
And then we grew. You know, across it, just about not every country in Asia, but certainly, you know, China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, India, Malaysia, and then into Europe. It was great.
And Greg, for someone watching who hasn't had these experiences that you have had, what do you think was the most exciting phase for you? Was it like being that individual consultant, making placements and making commission? Was it being the director or regional head of a business? Was it running a growing agency, or again, now a CEO of a large agency scaling up? What was most fun? Right.
Well, I think the most fun I've ever had in recruitment is being what I would describe as a billing manager. And that is when you are billing, or at least you're selling and you're out to clients, but you're also managing recruiters. I am good at that job. I was good at that job.
Yeah.
And because I had the ability to leverage through people, and I got a lot of fun out of helping other people succeed. Not always altruistically. I would succeed because of their success. So, but I loved that, and you know, I was around a tight ship, and I was quite good at that. Running as a CEO of a company like both Recruitment Solutions and Aquent, very exciting when it's going well. Very stressful, of course, in downturns and when things are not going well. I enjoyed growing Aquent internationally because I was learning so much about cultures and different recruitment markets across the world. That was a lot of fun. It's all been fun.
Yeah,
a 40-year dream run.
And because you're one of the very few people that is in recruitment 40-plus years and has succeeded at the scale you have, do you think the recruitment as a business is more competitive today than it was before, or do you think it was harder
before? Remember that while you talk about the success I've had a bit, it's all built on a myriad of failures, right? I mean, I have failed so many times at things, but you've got to try things, you've got to experiment, you learn, you get better. I make a lot less mistakes now, and really that's what my clients come to me for, is just to, all of whom are growing businesses and have reached their level of incompetence. And what I mean by that is they're not incompetent, but they've reached, every day they come into work, they're doing something they've never done before because their businesses are getting bigger, and I've been through that, so it's helpful. But to answer your specific question, which was what?
Do you think
is it more competitive?
Yeah, is it harder? If you're a 25-year-old getting into recruitment, was the job harder to do in the 1980s, or is it harder to do today?
I think it's harder now.
And why? Right? Like,
I think it's harder now because I think that when I started, and for the first 10 years, your success was predicated on your personality and your relationship building skills. And if you did the work to open those doors and have those conversations, you could build long lasting relationships that weren't predicated on price and speed. And now, as the industry's, prior to COVID, the industry got extraordinarily transactional. And really, to be perfectly honest, many recruiters, I shouldn't say most, were no more than keyword matching spammers. Yeah. and no disrespect, but they didn't really build rapport, relationships, credibility. They weren't influencers at all. They were racing to get a resume in front of someone, which frankly, a machine can do better. Yeah. COVID and what we've been through and are going through has actually had one very, very good side benefit in that some people have recalibrated where the value is. And now I'm on the board of a number of companies that are involved in HR tech and all the rest of it. And it is no doubt that technology is going to play a huge part in recruitment, and a lot of it's being automated. But the part that has the real value cannot be automated at this point. And so now recruiters have to be good at tech. They've got to be good at human influencing skills.
Yeah.
And most of them are not good at either, or certainly not both.
Both. Got it. And Greg, now a follow-up question to this, right? So obviously you have like this super rich experience, and anyone new starting in or someone who's running a new agency would probably benefit from it, which is why you have an agency, an academy now, right? Yeah. So can you tell us a little more about the academy in the sense that what do you teach? How long are the programs?
Right.
How much do they cost? Stuff like
sure.
that.
So my main business activity when I work is as an advisor to recruitment companies in real life. Obviously, COVID's changed that, but you know, in Australia, several cities in New Zealand and Singapore and Canada, and mostly I would go to those places and have board meetings, and our goal is growth. It's growing those companies. That's my main job. But over the years, I've done public speaking all over the world, and a lot of it's been videoed. And so I have put together, or people have helped me put together, it's about 25 hours of the best training for both recruiters, billing managers, and directors. And I'm updating it every quarter. Not the solution. So we call it the Academy, which is a grand name for an online learning system of video content.
Got it.
I think it's high quality. I think it's very relevant. Certainly it was well received and has always been well received. I see it as an adjunct to a company's other training. It's not as if you can just put someone in front of it and say, you're done. There is no, you know, most learning comes from coaching, actually. But it's a great framework. It's a platform. And it's a subscription model. So companies subscribe, depending on their size. They might get 5 licenses or 10 or 20, depending on their staff. People can access it, and they pay quarterly, and you can stop at any time. So it's really just a tool to help people. I think, you know, you probably know this. I think you do because your own company client base reflects this. But the majority of recruitment companies in the world have less, 80%, have less than 10 staff, which means the owner is billing, managing, trying to train, and training suffers, right? Training suffers, therefore retention suffers and productivity suffers. So we've got to get better at training people in our industry. And my academy is just one small contribution to that, but a good one. It'll help.
And so this academy / course, what would that cost a company, either for yearly, quarterly subscription? Do you rough?
It depends on the size. I think from memory, like if you've got less than 5 staff, it might be, don't quote me, it's on the website, might be $600 a quarter. So very affordable,
$600 a quarter. And is that per person or just for your entire company?
No, that's for 6 staff. If you've got less than 10 staff, it might go to $800. 10 to 20, I can't remember.
Got it.
But
that's not bad.
Very affordable, really.
Yeah, so 600 Australian, which would probably be 500 US or like £400.
Yeah,
or something
450.
Like that. Solid. And what's the website they can find the academy on?
Well, if you go to my website, which is gregsavage.com.au, you'll find the blog, you'll find the other resources. The top right, it will say the Savage Recruitment Academy. Click on that, it takes you straight to it.
Solid. And now, Greg, towards the closing, right? What would be advice you would give your own 20-year-old self? Like if you went back in time and if you had to talk to yourself and you were like, do this or don't do this, what would you tell yourself?
I'd say to myself, ask that pretty girl out. Nothing can go wrong. You've got nothing to lose. that's the first thing I'd say. And the second thing I'd say is there's several things I'd say I was going to give you advice for a young recruiter, but we'll do that later if you want to know. The thing I'd say to myself is listen more, open your mind, ask questions, be slow to be purposely. As I got more experience, I got very quick to judge a situation and go, somebody would come to me and say, Greg, I'm struggling. I'd go, right, yep, I got it. What you need is more of this. And as I learned, is life is much more nuanced than that. You know, people have different issues driving them. Someone who comes along and says they're struggling with something, it's the actual message is I've got a problem in something else. Yeah. So my advice to myself is be slower to understand, ask better questions, be more patient, be less quick to with the smart judge. Comment.
Yeah.
I got much better at this, you know, and I'm good at it now, I think. But be focused on not pointing out only why people are not good at something, but what is good and what they are doing well, and that is just equally good. Yeah.
Is it more about like having more EQ versus just IQ and being smart, or something more nuanced?
I don't think I've got a very high IQ. Okay. I think I'm average intelligence. Seriously, no false modesty. I think I'm. But I think I'm very good influencer of people's, and I mean that in a positive way, helping people see a better way to do things. And yeah, you could call they'd call it EQ now.
Yeah.
Potentially, they'd call it EQ now, but it's listening skills. It's being slower to judge what the answer is. I was very quick to give the answer when I didn't really know the circumstances.
And Greg, today, if when you talk to like a lot of new recruitment business owners or people who want to become business owners, what are a couple things you tell them? What do you think is the most important skill set that someone needs to develop to be successful in this business?
Well, that's like saying how to become a good parent or a good footballer. It takes a lot. But I would say, first of all, they need a clear plan and strategy. I think success in business is made up of three things: character. So you've got to have the resilience and the determination and bravery and all those things. Secondly, a strategy. It doesn't have to be a Harvard-developed strategy, but they need a lot of people's strategy when they start a recruitment company is to work hard. Now, that's good, and it's given, but you need a plan, what market, what vertical, how we're going to differentiate. And the third thing is implementation. Some people have a great strategy. I've sat around board tables where the strategy is genius, but then no one implements it. So it's those three things. So my advice to people would be have a plan with great clarity. Understand your own skill set. You're the owner. It doesn't mean to say you have to manage people.
Yep.
What is your skill set? You might be better at rainmaking, so let's go and do that and have somebody else grow as the leader of and the coach of consultants. That's fine. You don't have to be the boss in that way.
And what about the money piece, Greg? Because like someone starting a new firm, they're not going to make money the first few months or you know, the first 6 months. And so how do you tell people to plan cash flow and they plan their nest egg when they get started? Save did not come from a big exit.
Well, there are a lot of, in this country anyway, funding options for people who can fund their business against their cash flow. Particularly if you're growing a temporary business, you're going to need cash.
Yeah.
And I think you do need some cash. Obviously, you need some cash to start, and that's why the owner has got to bill, and the owner's got to not think of financial return in the short term. The smartest thing once you're billing is to use that cash to hire another person who you help succeed, and then you leverage. That person gets fairly paid, but you obviously make money from their efforts. And once you start to get that momentum, the cash will take care of itself as long as you collect it on time.
Yeah. And Greg, would it be right to say that you're basically saying even if someone has 100 grand in the bank right now, if they're just starting out, they should just do it solo till they have a business that's working with cash flow before they start hiring folks?
I mean, your biggest cost in a recruitment business, and typically if you look at the P&L of any recruitment business, 70-80% is salaries.
Yeah.
So, and our industry has at least 50% staff turnover. So I would encourage somebody, if they've got a good person who they know that maybe they come from the same agency as they did before, that might be a smart time to hire a second person. But I wouldn't hire a rookie until you had momentum with your cash. Because if you hire a rookie, they're going to cost money before they build anything, and it's going to divert your time too. That's a double whammy. You need to do that, but a better way to start, I mean, when we started Recruitment Solutions, we started with 9 people on day 1, all experienced. We made our first placement on day 4, and we were away.
But that's not the story for 99% of the people playing this game, right?
It's not. But the lesson is still good that if you, I mean, 2 of you could start on day 1 if you were confident that you were going to be billing quickly. But if you're investing in a slow burn recruiter, which you will do, then I wouldn't do that unless the cash was, you know, very, very substantially covering it. Yeah.
Till you have a real business. And Greg, what's your personal situation like? Are you married, kids, grandkids, dogs, cats?
I've been married for 25 years. I have 3 children, only one left at home. He's down the hall there. I live quite close to Sydney Harbour. And, you know, if it wasn't for COVID, I probably would have wound back my work activities and be doing more traveling and other things. But actually, people really needed help in the last 18 months. Yeah. Most of my consulting career has been about growth, but in the last 2 years, it's helping people survive. And I've been through a lot of recessions, obviously never COVID, but a lot of recessions. So I think I was helpful, felt as though I was helpful in both strategically getting people to get their costs under control, focusing on the right things, but also emotionally. A lot of people, extremely difficult for a lot of people who are running big businesses to find they have to let half their staff go. The fear of losing their house and their business, pretty tough time. We've got through that mostly, even though we are in lockdown in Sydney again. We've got through that mostly. And so, that's why I probably worked quite hard in the last couple of years, willingly, but because there was purpose, you know, something really important to do.
Yeah, and Greg, last question, right? So what's the plan for the future? Do you intend to, like, keep doing this till your last day on earth? Or, like,
that, but there isn't any piece of work I do that I don't enjoy.
Yeah.
And there isn't any client I work with that I don't like. So for me, it's not really work. I love recruitment. I love helping people succeed. One of the companies I started helping, they only had 3 staff. It was 5 years ago. Last year, we with 50 staff, we sold it to a Japanese company at great benefit to everybody. I'm still on the board as the chairman. Another company I helped start called People to People. I was the major shareholder. I didn't do any work, but I was the major shareholder. They now turn over 120 million. I've sold my shares to the CEO. Yeah, those things are exciting to be part of, and they're enriching relationships. And so for me, it's not work to go in and meet with those people. I mean, it is work, but I do it because I love to see the success. I benefit from the success. They benefit from the success. And recruitment is basically a good thing. Every day I go to work, if I'm successful, I help people find more people jobs and help companies grow. It's intrinsically a good thing. So I sleep well.
That's incredible.
But that's also the charade.
Yeah. I love it, Greg. Thank you so much for doing this. This was incredible. And I'm sure people will love it.
It's an absolute pleasure. So I would love people to subscribe to my blog. I blog every week, gregsavage.com.au. You can buy my book. All the proceeds of the book I give to charity. We've sold 10,000. But it is very, I think, helpful for people in recruitment. And the Academy, yeah, it's great stuff if it's the right timing for your company to have that sort of training. So there's my sales pitch, but I don't mind if you don't take those things up either.
Brilliant. Guys, you know where to find Greg if you need him. And Greg, thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Sean.
And that's all for today's episode of Recruitment Entrepreneurs. Like and follow us if you like today's episode and want to hear more stories from the world of recruitment.